Hello, Pam.
Hi, David.
I'm talking to Pam McKinnon this morning, just days after your nomination for Tony for Clyburn Park. Congratulations.
Right. That's right. I'm still in this crazy whirlwind.
Yeah, is it a whirlwind?
It is a whirlwind. Had a huge morning of press yesterday where all the nominees met. I mean, supposedly met, but it's more sort of like, you know, went from station to station speaking to press. I met very few nominees, but spoke to a lot of the press. But I think we were all there. No, it's incredibly exciting.
Is this your first directing on Broadway experience?
Yes. Yeah.
Thought so. I mean, it's overdue, but how wonderful. And, of course, we all sort of followed the drama of it's on again, off again, on again. And so here you are at the end of all of that, standing with a Tony nomination.
Yeah, it's fantastic, you know, and I'm so happy for everyone involved. I mean, I've known Bruce now for almost 17 years, and this is our third project together. And it's just really, really exciting. Great ensemble of actors and, you know, designers and actors who've been with this project now for more than 2 years, and here we are.
Yeah. And yeah, let's talk about that because it's so interesting where you came into this, how you came into it, you personally and also some of these actors. So you were saying that you did a cold reading of this at Playwrights. Talk to me about how you first came to the play.
Playwrights Horizons decided to do Bruce's play, and it was, I guess, the second play of his that they committed to. Bruce had wanted to work with me again, and so he checked in with Playwrights, and they said, yeah, we've been wanting to work with Pam, that's great, see if she likes the play, and Bruce handed me the play, and that was, you know, maybe 2.5 years ago, maybe even a little longer ago than that. And then Playwrights.
State was the play in at that point. It was freshman.
Well, Bruce, I mean, Bruce really doesn't let a play out of his apartment until it's pretty good to go. Mm-hmm. You know, he tinkers and tinkers and tinkers. You know, very much on his own. He just a couple weeks ago actually gave me what he says is like a really early draft of another play of his, and this one I might actually believe him, but by the time it was in Playwrights Horizons' hands, by the time he was shopping Clyburn Park around, it was pretty set. I mean, in the rehearsal hall, Bruce certainly does some rewriting, and there was a little bit of trimming, and you know, a few sentences added here or there. But you know, unlike a lot of writers that I work with, it's pretty much on the page.
Yeah.
He's a very meticulous, really strong voice. I'm not going to give this to anyone until it's kind of there, writer. And that's not to say that he isn't collaborative, because he certainly is. And you know, there were definitely moments in rehearsal where actors asked questions and lines got rearranged and things like that. But it's not as if the rehearsal process was like, you know, a moment of sort of standard kind of new play development. And thank God, because the rehearsal process is so quick, and it was such a big play to put up the first time.
Yeah.
But about 2.5 years ago, once it was already set for Playwrights Horizons next season, we did a cold reading of the play, and it was the first public reading of it. I think Bruce had, prior to my involvement, one or two like closed door, table reads of the play for producers to hear. But this first public read had four of the ongoing seven actors who remain with the project. Even the actors have been with this for, an incredibly long time. And we were so blown away at the reading. It was such an exciting play to hear. And then we made an offer to a fifth actor in our casting process. And then I met the two, the final two of the seven through auditions. So people have been with it for a very long time. And then we did it at Playwrights Horizons. It had, you know, a very successful but brief run, the way those are. And then about a year and a half after the Playwrights Horizons run, and you know, and its subsequent Pulitzer and several regional productions and production of the Royal Court that transferred to a commercial West End production, you know, and these are all productions that I had nothing to do with, but
yeah.
The play just sort of grew in stature. Michael Ritchie at Center Theatre Group approached Bruce, and he wanted to do Clybourne Park, but more specifically, he wanted to do the Playwrights Horizons, my production of it, because he really fell in love with it when he saw it. And Bruce gave me a call and said, I have no idea if this fits into your life or you're even interested in going back. I mean, in the early moments of Clybourne Park's regional step through, Bruce had asked me to direct a production of it. And I, you know, at that point just said, I can't imagine doing this with other actors.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have to respectfully decline. Like, it's, you know, it's that thing of, like, I really felt like the constellation of people were just so important to the whole, you know, the whole endeavor, that the idea of now going back in and completely, you know, redoing it, possibly with a different design team, most certainly with different actors, just made me feel kind of sad. And I didn't want to tempt fate, I had said no, but Los Angeles interested me. It was a different, you know, a very different space, and it was a producer who was very committed to do my production.
Right, including your actors.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so, you know, let's do it again at quote unquote a bigger scale. It's outside of New York, but it's, you know, it's 770 seats or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was even interested in seeing, you know, how it would work in a big thrust space. Like, it was both the production but with a big new untried element for me.
Yeah.
Let me ask
you this. Had the play, it's so interesting, I love how precise you are, and this is also what makes you such a wonderful director. The play had grown in stature, is what you just said, which of course is what it did. Had the play changed in any way when you went back to it? Did you encounter it as, an evolved relationship, like you would if you had missed seeing somebody over a year as they grew up, or was the play really mostly changed by the venue itself? Your experience when you went back to the production, was your challenge mostly there?
Yeah, I think it was the venue, but it was also interesting because I really felt like all of us, or maybe I should just speak for myself, that had grown as artists.
Yeah.
You know, in that year and a half, I had probably directed, you know, eight other productions. including like some great American plays. I directed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Death of a Salesman in the interim. You know, and sort of felt stronger. I just simply felt stronger. And so, you know, sort of the play on the page hadn't changed. It's sort of, you know, public stature had shifted a bit. You know, like the Pulitzer has some weight to it. But, you know, we sort of, and the actors included, had been really busy, and we came back to this thing which we knew and loved and knew that we had sort of, you know, knocked it out of the park the first go-round, but really running on sort of spirit and adrenaline and love, but you know, a really quick process. And so going back to it was sort of, it was all about, oh, we get to breathe through this one and get to really talk through this one and really dig in. And, you know, and definitely part of my project in revisiting it was to make sure that the ugliness within Bruce's genuinely funny play was never forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, that there's a real, you know, obviously personal tragedy that is sort of the heart of Act One, but that Carl Lindner and these discussions among the three white men are really racist, like no doubt about it. So I was very interested in, and some of it is just sort of it's a shift in pacing. It's sort of a demand of my actors to really, you know, sort of commit to those big needs. So that was for me sort of an upfront project that I brought into the rehearsal hall. And it was also interesting to learn, and Bruce, who has been with this play, sort of like, you know, he was sort of the collaborator who, you know, I had I think one production of a different play of his, Parallelogram at Steppenwolf, but by and large his 2 years had been spent still in Clybourne Park, you know, going from production to production. Some early on in a very hands-on way, and later, you know, sort of I can come in for 2 days of table work, or I will see a preview, but still like very much seeing this play. So what he had learned hopping from different venues was that this play plays differently in a big space, and I sensed that, but it was interesting to really learn that in Los Angeles, and then, you know, continue to learn that at the Walter Kerr on Broadway, that he wrote a big Boulevard play, and where we would get like one laugh at Playwright's Horizons, followed by a smile and a nod, you know, sort of charting what are now three big laughs in big spaces. There's something amazing about a larger room that lets an audience sort of biologically become anonymous, and we now land all these laughs that at Playwright's Horizons at times felt a little bit, oh, Bruce, this is gratuitous, like, let it go. But he was right, you know, in a different venue. The audience just wants in.
Yeah, you're talking about something that's really very infrequently discussed or even we don't really invest it, which is we talk about new play development and we assume it's the job of the playwright and the script. But actually what you're talking about is the development of the production of the play as something that evolves. And, you know, nothing in what you're saying is about going back to Bruce and saying we need to change that. We, you know, oh, that second act, it's really, you know, it's too big a leap for everybody. It's too racist, it's scary for the, you know, regional audience. Nothing went to Bruce, or maybe that's overstated, but in what you're talking about, the play existed, and pretty much even from that cold read, and everything about its development was developing the understanding of the people producing the play about how it works.
Yeah. And just
that,
you know, if Bruce's play was this sort of athletic skeleton, we just, you know, I had the opportunity with these actors and with these designers to just continue to add muscle.
And he had
already created something that could withstand a lot. And just become stronger and stronger, you know. And that said, in Los Angeles, he wrote, you know, probably seven new lines, and it sort of became, you know, a little bit of a game in that I demanded, because he started out doing this just because this was the paper lying around, but I demanded that it become, you know, a thing. Maybe it's my superstitious nature, but that he wrote them out on Post-its and handed them individually to the actors. You know, and some of them were in Act Two. There are a number of places where we have a lot of overlapping dialogue, and we just wanted more. And some of it was in the bigger space, sort of cacophony of three is better than, you know, like only two people talking at once.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so those new lines got handed in. There were definitely some things that just sort of learning rhythmically and musically, that he, you know, his ear sort of listening to it for the umpteenth time was sort of like, actually, Steve, the character Steve should say whoa again, and let's find where that is.
Yeah.
But, you know, tiny little grace notes, but very fun, very gratifying. You know, and I think,
you know,
fun for the actors to still be in a, you know, a living and breathing process.
Yeah. When we did Home at the Zoo, Mr. Albee was around, he actually made a change to Zoo Story.
It's really exciting.
But
yeah.
It's like, wow.
Amazing, right?
You know?
Well, when I did, it was then called Peter and Jerry, but At Home at the Zoo, the world premiere of that, and then the subsequent New York production, Yeah, it was very, very gratifying. But there was one day where we were sort of at a standstill in the Zoo Story. It's just a really hard play.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's two guys and the triangle of myself and those two actors, we were just at loggerheads in this really difficult moment. And I called Edward in. I sort of said, you know, I need your help. And so he came in and we talked about some things, and there was sort of one of those like frowny rehearsals, and then he said to I think my assistant director, let me see the script. And you know, she came over with a binder, and he leafed through it, and he crossed out a whole page and a half of the Zoo Story that day.
Wow.
And he said, go back and rehearse it that way, see if that helps.
Uh-huh.
It was amazing. I mean, it's a 50-year-old play, but you know, it was that's certainly the ultimate power of the playwright. Like, I can't do that.
He's
able to do that. And what I think Edward was sort of doing, having lived with this play himself for 50 years, I'm sure there's some language in there that feels like, oh, that young writer, he just goes on and on. He has the power to, you know, X out stuff that sort of mortifies him now. But also, I think more importantly, what he was doing is sort of recognizing, oh, this is a living, breathing rehearsal process. These guys are for whatever reason, stuck. I can unstick them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, it's also, it's the sense of a play as alive to its production, rather than having to be fixed in its production.
Yep, that's really interesting. That's really cogent. Yeah.
Yeah,
that we're sort of all in this together, and you know, he can always go back and restore that page and a half, but
right.
For whatever reason, you know, this production needs to skip it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's really fascinating. You have you're still involved with this production of Virginia Woolf, are you not?
Oh yeah. I'm super excited to go back to that one, and that will actually, in a weird way, very coincidentally, be a similar rhythm to what happened with Clybourne Park. I mean, it's all the original actors, it's all the original designers. Started at Steppenwolf, then we got to hop that to Arena. Where, you know, it just continued to grow and grow, and now, you know, almost 2 years later from the original start date, I will have a full rehearsal process yet again. All of us have been incredibly busy, and we're going to go back and see who we are, you know, in relationship to that production and that text.
That's fantastic. You know, I want to just take a brief detour into that, because I think something happened there, too, that doesn't happen enough. You know, because I was part of that set of decisions at the beginning of putting that production together, and you had done such a beautiful job with A Delicate Balance at Arena.
Mm-hmm.
And even in those strange circumstances of doing theater in the basement of a mall.
Yeah, it was really exciting. Super exciting. Yeah.
But it was just a brilliant production of that play, and I know that Mr. Albee felt the same. And so, you know, it was a no-brainer to say, oh, let's ask Pam, you know, to be part of this festival that we're doing. And we asked you who your dream actors were, and you named Tracy and Amy for those roles. And then both institutions set about making that possible. And going that direction, because it's not normal, but, you know, that's not an organization that ensemble isn't able to co-produce very successfully. They can make their pieces and then take them places, but it's not natural. They hadn't been doing it, Albee's work, for years. But just the notion
that you're
the artist we're focused on, and Edward we're focused on, and he's focused on you as well, so let's ask and then go get that done.
That was pretty amazing. I think it's part of why it's special. Yeah, well, and Edward had actually never allowed Steppenwolf to do any of his plays.
Right.
That was the first production he'd ever allowed them to do, and they had asked in the past.
Yeah.
But he was very reluctant. I think going way, way back when, you know, sort of Steppenwolf had, rightly or wrongly, more of that kind of, you know, we're actors and we're going to show you how it's done, little playwright, you know, kind of reputation. And Edward was like, well, I'll just take my toys and go home.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a hard reputation to shake, you know, and so...
Especially when
you're
making it over and over again, like they were succeeding at that as a company. That was their identity of this really, you know, robust and aggressive acting.
The whole Chicago style, and this was a company of actors, you know. And I think and obviously that has definitely changed. I mean, they're now a hugely nurturing, house for playwrights. I mean, that's where Bruce Norris comes from. That's where Tracy Letts comes from. You know, it's now a real combination of, yes, we have a company of actors. We are committed to those people and, you know, still largely that Chicago acting style. But, you know, we commission and support writers.
Right. Well, and everybody's generating the work there. You know, I think that's really a wonderful thing to point out now is not just the playwrights, but also you've got you know, Tina Landau making productions there that she's
Frank Galati,
these ensemble members who are generative artists in a lot of ways it must relate to the way they always thought about actors as generating the performance anyway. So if you're here as a playwright or if you're here as a director, it's the same thing. You're making your work, you know.
Right, and you know, and Amy Morton directs there a lot, which she, you know, really values. And I know after playing Martha, you know, for really, you know, substantial regional runs in Virginia Woolf at Steppenwolf and at Arena Stage, she was like, I don't want to act for a while. And so last season at Steppenwolf, she directed two shows, actually including Clybourne Park, so...
Yeah, oh, that's right. She did. That's funny. Wow. And so let me ask you this then. In your, what's your, I don't assume that you have a, I guess you have a starting point each time as a director. When you're at that cold read, first of all, let's talk about that real quickly, because that cold read, what a consequential thing, a cold read of Clybourne Park, and that wasn't anybody's choice as the best alternative. That was what was available, was to just get everybody in the room to read it out loud, right? It's not because that's a smart or effective, generally, choice for how to hear a play the first time in front of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the right cast, but you only sort of recognize that in retrospect, that's exactly the way I like to do it. You know, it's sort of like, you know, people are then going in with, you know, pure instinct. You know, smart actors running on pure instinct. If they're, you know, if they're right for the role, boom. That's the best way, I think, to hear a play. You know, there is sort of that dangerous thing sometimes in a reading, where if you rehearse it, you can block some of those instincts, and so actually the public moment of that day, rehearsal followed by reading, can be, you know, just that tiniest bit underwater. But it has to be the right cast.
I'll be there. You sound just like Edward Albee, who is very fond of saying the play, you know, you'll read the play out loud the first time without rehearsal, and then you won't get it back again until
open. Right. You have to then be in the swamp for a while, and then you come back home.
Which I think is true, with
the right cast. Yeah, it is about casting. And, you know, we lucked out, but definitely it was... You know, it was because I was in rehearsal for something else that I couldn't, you know, I couldn't be there for, you know, the morning, early afternoon. I could only be there at 5 p.m., so that's when we scheduled the reading. You know, I think we got together at 4:30. I, you know, said, you know, basically, you know, speak quickly and want something, and, you know, this room is deceptively, you know, larger than you think it is, so a little bit of volume would be great, and okay, here come some people, let's do it.
Well, and I guess it's also Playwrights Horizons creates a safe space for that, so there's while the stakes were enormous, and when you look back on it on that reading, I can imagine that playwrights have a knack for taking some of that pressure off of that moment that you didn't feel.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it was also, though, this was like really at the height of the recession, and you know, part of the desperate reason for this reading is we were trying to get a co-producer. There was another not-for-profit theater who will go nameless in this conversation who was interested, and after the cold read, for whatever reason, they decided not to.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, then, yes, let's leave that out. Because that was a mistake.
Yeah, it was a mistake. But people make mistakes. I mean,
that's
you know.
And aesthetics are what they are. They're personal.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
I mean, I know even just from this notion of the number of conversations before the stature of the play was, you know, confirmed and solidified, the number of conversations Bruce must have had, and I'm sure you were in, about the break between the two acts and the difference of those two acts. I'm sure, you know, that conversation has happened everywhere.
Yep, absolutely.
Up until it's, you know, well, I'm sure it still continues, but it's so interesting that these things that break the rules continue to be challenged as rule breakers, but in many ways they, you know, I think part of its success, a big part of its success, is the ways in which it's breaking rules.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of its stature. So.
Mm-hmm.
But yep. It's interesting. I don't know if you feel this. I guess maybe this is true. That I felt this when we were working on Delicate Balance, too. I was listening to that play over and over again. And I had this fear that in our current world of play development, we would have really gone to war over some of the repetitions and some of the you know, those wonderful attempts that the characters make to find the precise word. And I was wondering if in our world today that play would have been that play.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, you know, even you know, sort of in rehearsing, I think especially some of Edward's older plays, you know, sort of part of the rehearsal process is to like find the bloody action when his characters go off and start, quote, telling a story.
Right.
You know, and it's hard. You know, and it's delicate. It is a delicate balance, you know, because it sort of is, okay, how is this germane? I understand, you know, sort of the, excuse me, the larger metaphor. I understand why this is here in a very intellectual way. Why is Tobias talking about this right here, right now, to these people in this room? And it can be really, you know, sort of deliciously hard. And I think sometimes in a new play setting, those can be sort of like, yay, the playwright cut it.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Now we're free to move on. Yay. But that actually, not like the cap story, is now one of the most heartbreaking things in, you know, American dramatic literature, you know.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Well, I know you're in a whirlwind, and I'm just thinking of you and rooting for you, and I know, you know, I cannot wait to see Virginia Woolf when it gets back on its feet.
Me too.
What are you doing between now and then? Is Woolf taking your focus now, or is there a project that you're still between now and then that we're going to see you on the stage?
Many, many projects. I go into a two-week workshop on Monday with a young writer, Sylvan Oswald.
Sylvan.
Yeah, it's great. It's a play called Profanity, and we're doing a two-week workshop of it with sort of no strings attached, which is great, at Soho Rep. So that's, you know, my first part of May. And then I'm currently in design and casting. I'm doing some short plays by Horton Foote at Primary Stages, and Hallie Foote is going to be involved. So that takes me through my summer. And in the interim, I'm doing some readings of plays with Club Thumb, as well as a play by Sherry Wilner. And then I drop into Virginia Woolf land.
Wow.
Wow.
This is a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah, it feels like a lot, and it is a lot.
Is it fun? Do you like the juggling, or does it feel a little bit like, oh, things are piling up?
Well, to be honest, I love the juggling, but I'm not 100% sure how all these readings are going to fit in. You know, Readings sort of when you open your calendar, sort of like, oh, it's one day, but it's not one day. It's, you know, it's several days, you know, ideally sitting with the playwright. It's also casting, which is so crucial and, you know, takes a lot of time. And so, you know, that's a little bit where I'm holding, you know, the tiniest bit. I wouldn't even call it anxiety, but a little bit of nerves. And then, you know, Clybourne Park, the press stuff just keeps on percolating, which is fantastic and exciting and as it should be. But it's also sort of like, oh, there goes that Thursday. But it's super exciting. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
And John is coming down to Arena Stage. My boyfriend is going to be doing a show at Arena, so that's exciting.
What's he doing?
Yeah, he's going to be in the Normal Heart.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it's really great.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, I wish for everybody that they have the opportunity to see you in those moments where you would describe yourself as, you know, a little under pressure or whatever, however you just described it, because I've rarely seen someone who is as calm and as, you know, keeps a room as calm and focused as you do. And I just, it's really a treat to watch your work, and I hope everybody has
that
opportunity.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
And every playwright should have that, have you at their side.
Aw, nice.
Well, good luck to you, and I will see you. I'm not sure where next, but in one of those projects, I will be in the room.
That's great, David. Thank you.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks. Bye.